Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is drummer extraordinaire Mark Schulman. But first, let's talk about 7 tips for Facebook video. Facebook is really getting into the video business big time. They're trying to rival YouTube. And actually, it's a good thing because you'll find that if you really want major engagement, now is the time to post your videos on Facebook. And what that means is not just an embed from YouTube, it means a direct post, an upload to Facebook. And what you're going to find is this is going to help a bunch because all of a sudden a lot more people are going to see it than normal. As you know, a Facebook post really doesn't reach a lot of people anymore. It's down to about 6% of your total following. So in other words, if you have 100 followers and you post something, chances are only about 6 of them might see it. Now, this may go up or down depending on time, depending on the type of post, depending whether there's a graphic involved. But generally speaking, now it's down from last year, it was about 15%, 11%, somewhere in there, and now it's down to 6. Well, you have a chance to exceed that thanks to the new emphasis on video by Facebook. But if you want to do that and you want to do a good job, there's a number of tips. So let's go down the list here. The first one is limit the footage to 5 minutes. So in other words, the video shouldn't be longer than 5 minutes. This is a good idea anyway, but on Facebook, it's really important. As you get to the 5 minute area, almost everybody tends to fall off. It's really difficult to have a very long video on Facebook and have someone watch it all the way through, and you get penalized for that. So the best thing is to keep your videos short and sweet, and anything less than 5 minutes keeps you in the ballpark. So that's number one. Number two, create a good thumbnail for it. And this is kind of easy. It takes a little time, but really it's not very hard. All you have to do is do a screen cap of a frame of the video. And what you'll do is you'll get something that's really interesting. So just go through, and when you find an interesting frame, do a screen cap and use that as your thumbnail. And you can upload that separately. It's always a really good idea to do that because, again, people a lot of times will judge whether they're going to watch your video or not on the basis of the thumbnail. So create a good thumbnail. Number three is create a catchy or unique title. And this seems pretty obvious, but you'd be surprised the number of people that will just use a generic title, and that doesn't work very well at all. So what you have to do is put your thinking cap on and come up with a really good, catchy title. And believe me, that's not easy. As someone who has to come up with titles every day for posts, believe me, it's not easy. But it's worth it. When you come up with something that's really good, you find that your engagement goes up, you find that your views go up, everything gets better. So it's worth spending the little extra time to come up with a much better or unique title for the video. Number four, check the keywords for similar videos. Keywords are important. They always were. They always will be. They're a little more important now on Facebook, especially on videos. And a way to figure out what good ones are, to look at other similar videos and look at what those keywords are. And you'll find that's kind of a neat little trick that you can use in order to get the best keywords for yourself. So that's number four, check keywords for similar videos. Number five, this may seem obvious, but a lot of people don't do it. Allow people to share your video. Now, you can restrict that if you want, but I can't think of a good reason that you should do that. So make sure you allow people to comment on it, to share it, do whatever it is that they need to engage with you and your video. It's really important. And that brings us to number six, encourage people to rate or share your video as well. You can't officially ask someone to like it. That's against the terms of use agreement that you made when you signed up with Facebook. Even though people do it sometimes, you can't officially ask someone to like a post or a video. What you can do is ask them to rate it or ask them to share it. And that's something you should do. And number seven, you should upload this to other sites. Don't just stay with Facebook. This should go to any number of, I think it's 102 other sites that actually accept video. There's an easy way to do this, so you don't have to do each one uniquely. There's a service called OneLoad, OneLoad, W-O-N-E-L-O-A-D, OneLoad.com. And all you have to do is load it once to OneLoad, and OneLoad will sign you on to all these other sites, We'll get a password for you if you don't already have it, and we'll automatically upload it in the right format. And that's worth its weight in gold. So check out OneLoad. So those are the 7 tips for Facebook video. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program, which is 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. And you can find out more by going to 101mixingtricks.com. Now let's go to audio production. I've been telling you about a lot of new developments over the last few weeks. There's the new USB connector. There's the new AVB format that's coming out. We talked about the new AES 3D audio standard a couple weeks ago. Well, there's something new. This is a new file format, and this is aimed specifically at DJs. This is by Native Instruments, and it's called STEMS. So in other words, STEMS is the name of the file format. And what it does is it gives you 4 distinct stereo parts, or 4 stems. So in other words, you can have the rhythm section, you can have the pads, you can have the lead vocal, and you can have all the tinkly other effects things, all in stereo, in one file that you can manipulate as you want. This has been tried before, and there's actually a number of other similar file formats that you can get right now. The difference is, this is the first time that a lot of the distribution services have actually adopted it. So pretty soon you'll be able to get it on Juno, Beatport, and TrackSource. And this makes a big difference because all of a sudden it becomes a legitimate file format. The other cool thing about this, even though it's made by Native Instruments or is created by Native Instruments, it's an open format. Anybody can use this. Anybody can create their own stems. And in fact, there's going to be a stem creator tool, free tool that's going to be distributed. So just about anybody can use this to make their own stems. Very cool. It's also based on the MP4. What's good about that is that makes it backward compatible, mostly for metadata. So if you're going to put a stem up on iTunes, for instance, it's the same metadata format, and that makes it kind of easy. The other thing is, if you're into Traktor Remix, this fits right in there because, of course, it's Native Instruments. So again, this is one of those things that's aimed at DJs, but who knows what'll happen, because many times you find that when you have an audio development that's aimed at one part of the market, another part finds a use for it and they pick it up. So who knows what'll happen. But anyway, it's something that should be aware of. It's called STEMS. It's a new file format, multi-channel file format. My guest today is Mark Schulman, who's one of the most in-demand drummers in the world, and he's played with major stars like Pink, Stevie Nicks, Foreigner, Sheryl Crow, Cher, and Velvet Revolver, among many, many others. He's also an in-demand corporate speaker and has a new book that's about to be released about conquering the stage fright of life. I spoke with Mark from his car via Skype. So Mark, thanks so much for being with me today. I really appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure, brother.
So, you must have been a really good cello player when you were a kid to be able to play in the Los Angeles Junior Philharmonic. How did you go from playing cello to being a drummer, being a great drummer?
Well, okay, let's back up a little bit. I appreciate the compliment, but I was a decent cello player as a kid. I always had the passion and the desire to play drums. As the story goes, I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, and I saw all the screaming girls, and I saw Paul, and I saw John, and then I saw Ringo, and I was transfixed. That was it. I'm like, I want that. And my brother was playing violin. My parents didn't want a drummer. Too loud. You know, I understand the desire deterrent from a kid being a drummer. So I was at my brother's violin lesson. He was taking violin lessons from my Uncle Ben, my godfather. And there was this kind of big-looking violin in the corner. I said, that looks kind of cool. Can I play that? And it was a cello. And my mom was delighted. My godfather was delighted. So I started playing cello. And the agreement was that at the end of every cello lesson, he'd give me a little mini drum lesson because he was a school teacher, so he had some basic knowledge of drumming as well. Playing cello, and I got pretty good at it because I practiced, but I was really interested in drums, and I finally got a drum set at 9 years old, and I was playing cello and playing drums. And but the moment I got the drum set, there was no turning back. And I continued to play cello. And it was really interesting because it actually really helped my ear. And then I became an engineer, and I've done a lot of production. And when you play a fretless instrument, it really refines the ear. And I ended up conducting the orchestra in my junior high school and playing the L.A. Junior Philharmonic. And I couldn't play all the parts, so the parts I couldn't play, I just skipped. But there were some great players in there. I did okay. And then pretty much by the time I was about 14 years old, I stopped playing cello. And the great thing is, though, I would always pick it up, you know, every few years, sometimes as infrequently as every 10 years. And I remember my brother bought me a Chinese cello, you know, when I was like, gosh, you know, damn near 40. And so I'd play around on it a little bit and pick it up every once in a while just to see if I still could make my way through it. And then fast forward to 2009, we're rehearsing for the Pink Tour, and we have a violinist, Jesse Green, is on the tour. And it's really awesome because that's sort of like changing the scope of everything. And they're trying to come up with creative ways of sort of saying things, the very fact that they had a violinist. And so there's one song, and there's no drums on the song. And I'm thinking, now, wait a minute, because Eva Gardner, my dear friend and the bass player of the Pink Tour, she plays stand-up bass. So I recommended, you know, I could play cello. Why don't we do a little string thing? And I kept on putting it out there to Paul Merkovich, the music director, and Pink. And eventually they thought it was kind of a good idea. And so we ended up getting together, and I worked really hard to play about 12 long notes. And I ended up playing cello in the Pink Tour. And the irony of it was I ended up getting a cello endorsement. I got like a $15,000 cello for free. It's the greatest endorsement gift I've ever gotten.
Wow.
All for playing about 12 long notes. and I tried to play it on the Share Tour. There was an opportunity, and I learned a whole part, and they were going to put it in, and then it got cut. It's okay. Cello's a beautiful instrument, but I really am a drummer. And I would never, you know, ironically, people were actually starting to, like, offer me cello gigs or asking if I'd play on their stuff. And I would just tell them, you know, I'm really not a cellist. You should get a real cellist. I could play a few long notes, but I'm not a cellist. If you want to hire me to play drums, that's what I do.
Well, speaking of drums, so what was your first professional gig as
my
a drummer?
My first professional gig was the night of my bar mitzvah. I was still 12 years old, and I was more excited because I was getting $50 to play with a horn band. My bar mitzvah was during the day. That night, I made $50, and I was about a week shy of turning 13 years old. And when I got paid $50 for playing drums, I thought, oh, no, this is the life that I want. This is what we're going to do here. And I never looked back.
What was your first gig that you had to go on the road for?
Well, I went on the road with my Top 40 band when I was 18 years old, touring through the Northwest Territory of Canada. You know, but my first sort of high-profile gig playing with a world-class artist was when I played with Brenda Russell, the R&B artist that had the hit Piano in the Dark, and we opened up for Billy Ocean. That was my first opportunity to actually tour different parts of the world, and it was extraordinary.
That's very cool. How did you get that gig?
Well, you know, I tell people that your network is your net worth, and it really is that way, because every gig I've ever gotten was as a referral from something else I had done or somebody I'd met. And my parents are both professors, retired professors. My father has since passed. My mom is going to be 86 in a week. And they taught at a junior college, and my mother ran the tutorial center, and I apparently inherited the grammar gene. My dad had written 4 grammar books, had a PhD in grammar composition. And so I used to tutor grammar when I was in college. And one of the guys I tutored was Armin Grimaldi. So I was 19, and Armin was 26. And he was playing with Claire Fisher, amazing drummer, and he ended up going out and playing with John Henley, very high-profile guy. And I moved away when I was 22 to Portland, and I moved back when I was 26, and I met this bass player named Mark Brown, and Mark and I became inseparable, and he was good friends with Armin. And apparently Armin got offered the Brenda Russell gig, and Mark Brown had told Armin about this new drummer he had met, Mark Shulman. Armin's like, I know Mark. We used to jam together when he was 19, because we used to jam together. We'd, you know, get two drum sets together when I was tutoring him in English. And he recommended me for the gig. And so I showed up, and I basically just needed to be able to perform well enough to keep the gig, because I didn't have to audition, because I came on Armand's recommendation. And that's how I got the gig, and it just sort of, I connected the dots from there as I met more and more people and created relationships. And I have a lot of stories I can tell about creating relationships and recognizing opportunities and creating opportunities when there weren't any.
Well, give me a story from that. That you know, that's one thing that most people, most musicians especially, are not good at.
Well, here's an example. So, as a result of the Brenda Russell tour, I started getting a decent reputation, I guess, because it went well and people had seen me, and people were calling me an R&B drummer, which is funny because I'm a rock drummer. Brenda Russell's R&B. I'm just a drummer that can play a lot of styles, as I recommend to any aspiring professional drummer. And then I got called by a manager named Alan Kovac, one of the big managers at the time, and he wanted me to come over and have a meeting because he wanted me to play with one of his, this like baby band. He had like an R&B band. Alan managed an artist who I had really wanted to play with since I had heard this artist. And I had heard through the grapevine this artist was going to be looking for a new drummer. So I go and I meet with Alan, and in the back of my mind, I basically have a bird in the hand. I have a gig offer right on the table. So do I tell Alan what I really want to do and chance that I'm going to anger him or that I might lose that opportunity if I tell him that the artist that I really want to play with is Richard Marx, who's one of his premier artists?
Yeah.
And so what do you think I did? Do you think I told him?
No.
I didn't. You're right. I took the other gig, and I was really grateful. And then all day, it's eating at me, saying, I'm thinking, you know what? I whipped out. I should have told him. And the next morning, I got up, and like 10 o'clock, right when I knew the office was going to open, before I could even think too much about it, I was dialing the phone. I called him up. I said, Alan, you know, the truth is that I really want to play with Richard Marx. My heart's palpitating, and I'm waiting for him to hang up on me on the other line. Well, man, I didn't even realize you were a rock drummer. You know, I had the big hair. I said, I'm whatever kind of drummer you want me to be, buddy. I said, I just love the opportunity. I really think that I'd be a great fit. And he said, He said, I'll tell you what, man. He said, you know, Mike DeRozier, that great drummer from Heart, had been doing the gig, and Mike was leaving the gig. He didn't want to do it anymore. I was right. He was looking for a new drummer. He said, you know, Mike DeRozier's going to do one last gig. Richard's record's coming out, so they're doing like a showcase gig at the Record Merchants Convention in New Orleans. So that's going to be DeRozier's last gig. Hey, well, after that, I'll get you an audition. We're the band. And I'm thinking, God, this is exciting. And then I just have this moment of clarity. Just bing, pops in my head. I said, Alan, I'll tell you what, man. Why don't you let that gig be my audition? And that way, if it goes well, I've just saved you guys the time, the energy, the money of finding a new guy. And if it doesn't go well, so you can just continue to audition other guys. I stop attending on the other line thinking, man, I'm so audacious. Who do I think I am? Then I realize that I'm speaking his language, you know, time, energy, money. So I'm like, okay,
yeah.
I'm talking this dude's language. He says, you know, man, I'll talk to Richard. I'll see how he feels. I'll call you back. Sure enough, he calls me back, says, you talk to Richard. Richard says he wants to meet me. If we get on well, I'm on. I meet Richard. We get on well. I do that gig. That gig turned into a 15-month tour, headlining arenas, touring the world, playing for like 95% screaming girls.
Not too shabby, huh?
Not too shabby. But that was an opportunity that I, you know, talk about seizing the opportunity, man. I created that. Now, I'm sure I would have gotten an audition, but my life could be very different. Because maybe I would have auditioned, maybe they would have selected somebody else, and the path would be very different. But I just seized it. And that's You need to be bold for what you want. You need to stand up for what you want. You need to hold your position for what you want. And that's the moral of the story for me.
I want to come back to that in a little bit, but you mentioned that you play a lot of different styles, and when I look at your resume, I see Foreigner and Billy Idol and Sheryl Crow and Cher and Destiny's Child, and that's a wide variety. So most musicians get typecast, and it seems like that's not the case with you. How did that happen?
Well, you know, I grew up listening to Steve Gadd, Jeff Caro, JR, of course, Buddy Rich, Tony Williams, Vinny, and, you know, the people that I have the most respect for are great musicians. They're not necessarily stylized. I mean, Buddy Rich was touched by God. He's stylized. And Tony Williams, but even Tony Williams, man, you know, you look at the chronology of Tony Williams, so he's like 17 years old just playing the shit out of bebop. And then he got really progressive in some of his records in the 80s where he's just slamming and playing like funk and rock. Great players have a great palate and a great vocabulary, and that's always what I wanted to be because I love different styles of music. It's more of the fact that I may, like, on my iPhone, I might listen to, like, Thomas Haake and Meshuggah, and then I might go listen to, like, you know, Tony Williams Kind of Blue, then I might go listen to, like, Joe Vitale playing in Joe Walsh's band, or, you know, yeah. I might listen to, like, Josh Freese in Perfect Circle, or I might listen to Vinny playing, like, some ridiculous solo with Charisma live. It's born of just a real love of music and a real desire. I want to play different stuff, man. It would be boring for me to play just one style of music. But having said that, you know, people say if you have the one album on the desert island, I would pick a Beatles album with Ringo, because I still love pop music the most.
Yeah. Is there a type of music that you have trouble with?
You know, not at all, because I feel like I try to find what I like. I mean, some music just resonates, other music doesn't. But just because it doesn't resonate with me, I still want to find what I like. Like, you know, I'm not a big rap music fan. I just kind of, like, maybe my generation, I sort of missed it. But, you know, I listen to, like, some people with phrase really, like, Eminem is a great rapper, man. Some of his phrasing is outstanding. It's kind of like, you know, reminds me of, like, Steve Gadd tap dancing or Buddy Rich tap dancing, you know?
Yeah.
You know, you got to dig it. So, you know, maybe, and, like, you know, there's some really, like, you know, math metal stuff that I might not really like the music, but, man, the drumming can be just so outstanding and so articulate that you can't help but appreciate it, at the very least, you know?
Yeah. Have you done anything with Odd Time Signatures?
Oh, a ton. Are you kidding me, man? When I do my seminars, I do all kinds of crazy stuff. I do all kinds of Odd Time Signatures and metric modulation and Indian music. And, oh, yeah, I love it.
Because
when I was 22, I learned the Black Page. the old nested grouping things, you know, like 5/2 and 7/3. And I educated myself in a lot of this stuff. You know, not that comes in that handy when you're playing with Pink, but and you never know, dude. You know, you throw stuff in, like, and you know, it's the greater your vocabulary, the more fun. I mean, I tell my students, you know, the better you get, the more fun you have. You know, the more you learn, the more you can play, the more fun it is. Like anything else, you just start expanding on concepts, and it's endless. And it's like the more I learn, the more I realize I don't know, which is crazy, but isn't that kind of the path of life?
Well, but what's interesting with you, you've grown beyond just being a musician, because now you have a book and you do public speaking and everything. Tell me about your book. How did Nerve Breakers come about?
Well, as I think I said earlier, my folks are both teachers, and my mom sort of illegally gave me my own class to teach when I was 19, and ESL students, English as second language students. And then I did my first drum clinic in 1991. For Seattle Drum School, Steve Smith, the other Steve Smith, and I did the clinic, and I realized, wow, I think I'm good at this. I'm good at getting up and communicating in front of people. And then I got into doing a lot of drum clinics, and I started to realize that I thought the more people were resonating with the stories and the sort of success coaching component of what I was talking about than simply the licks. And I started to realize, you know, I could take these ideas. Actually, it was Dom Famulano. Dom is such a mentor of mine, and I did a clinic tour in Germany with Dom in 1996. And I remember Dom telling me that he did a drum clinic, and some guy brought his kid, and the guy came up to him afterwards and said, "Man, that was so motivating. I'm the CEO of a company, man. Will you come out and speak to my company? Just do what you did, you know." And here we are, you know, making like 500, 700, 800 bucks a drum clinic, and the guy's like, "You know, I don't have that big of a budget, but I think I could pay you $7,000. Is that okay?" And Dom's like, "That's fine, you know." And it always stuck in the back of my head. I thought, you know, what we have to say in the life lessons and the experience that we have can be so useful, so critical, so helpful. To use music as the metaphor for performance in all types of performance. And I remember I made a decision in 2003. I thought, you know, I could be effective way beyond the scope of simply talking to 50 or 100 drummers in a room. I can tell my life stories and affect people and change people's lives in the corporate world, in the collegiate world, in support of at-risk and high-risk kids. I ended up joining the board of directors for a nonprofit called Create Now, and I'm still very active, and we mentor at-risk and high-risk and forgotten kids, and I've gone into detention camps and spoken to these kids and try to motivate them in any way that I can. So I started doing corporate gigs, maybe 2004, 2005, and I've continued to, on the sideline of touring, be a corporate speaker, so to speak, and do college gigs. I've quite done 2 dozen college gigs, five for the college kids. And then I realized, well, you know, I have a lot of information that I've accrued and a lot of inspiration, particularly from a gentleman who is still my life coach, one of my great inspirations, Dr. Jim Samuel, who has all these amazing philosophies. And I started incorporating his philosophies and refining his philosophies for my in my context. And I realized, you know, that'd be great to write a book. And so I decided to write a book based on my philosophies and some experiences I had. And early in my career, my first audition with Bad English was a dismal failure because I was so nervous and my internal sense of time was so affected and I sped up so badly. It was an impetus for me not only to spend 2 years mastering my internal meter, but to spend the next 20 years analyzing, studying, researching, networking, and discovering until I uncovered the habits and rituals that allowed me to bust through my fear and my nerves, both on and off the stage. And I thought, well, this would be a great thing to write about, because at a point, I was hanging out with a very successful corporate speaker buddy of mine, Paul Stoltz, and we're sitting here like drinking wine on his deck, and we realized that I played for nearly 1 billion people in my life. Wow. But that qualifies me to be sort of a considered opinion in being able to conquer fear and stage fright and performance anxiety and transform into confidence. So that's when Conquering Life Stage Fright was born. And maybe by the time this podcast is public, the book will be out, because we're actually about to enter the first pressing of the book. I'm very excited. It's called Conquering Life Stage Fright, 3 Steps to Top Performance. And I interviewed nearly 50 people, performers in all areas of life, ranging from Tony Hsieh, the CEO of Zappos, to Alan Bean, the astronaut, to Jeremy Piven, the actor. I interviewed Stuart Copeland and Denny Sewell. You know, this whole hybrid of different people. And I even talked to the gal who was the managing editor for Fortune magazine, Lee Gallagher, who ended up liking the concept so much she wrote the foreword to my book. So the top performance is top performance. And it's something that you can quantify and calculate. And the concepts that I talk about in my book are broad-based. And I'm speaking about it, and I do this sort of high energy, interactive. It's like a rock show disguised as a keynote. And I just did a gig for Johnson & Johnson and the CEO's Clubs of America, and I'm doing some for the Aviation Group and PacWest. I'm really doing more speaking. I'm not even on the road right at this point because the chair tour is done. So I'm doing more speaking and, of course, continuing to do more sessions and writing. And I even got a new band called The Bangables.
Oh, cool. You know, you just mentioned something before that you were having trouble with stage fright yourself and being nervous. And you don't seem like the type of guy that would have that kind of a problem. Was that from the beginning that you had that and is something you got over? How much did you work on it? Or did you just become more comfortable because you're doing all these gigs in front of a lot of people? How did that happen?
Well, that's kind of the whole concept of my book. I didn't have so much stage fright in the early days of my career, but when I was put in the context of the world class, that's when I buckled. Because I knew when I auditioned for Bad English, at some level, I was not prepared. I mean, my foundation wasn't secure enough. I had already done a lot of professional gigs and even worked with Quick Tracks, but my internal sense of time was not developed. This was a world-class band, and I was out of my league, and that audition kicked my ass. And it was great, because I probably wouldn't have done the work, because the three basic concepts of my book, the three steps, are clarity, capability, and confidence. And the very, very brief synopsis is you need real clear vision and crystal clear goals to understand exactly what it is you want to do relative to performing or presenting or communicating. And then you need to do the work. You need to thoroughly develop your capability. There's no substitution for the clarity and the capability. And that's what leads to pure, unadulterated confidence. Without that capability, if you go on stage or you go to give a speech or you even go to communicate and try to do a sales pitch, if you're unprepared, you should be scared.
Well,
there's no substitution for those concepts. So that's what I learned. And so then I go into very specific descriptions about how to refine your capability, how to refine your clarity and refine your capability, and how that leads to confidence and how others have done it. And at the end of each chapter of my book, I give their action steps, their exercises, very specific exercises. And there are different paths for different people because different people resonate with different things. So I try to touch on a myriad of different ways to accomplish this.
Well, you know, I find it very interesting, actually, that you have these three steps, especially the first one, clarity, because it seems to me that there are so many people in life, and especially musicians, that kind of drift from gig to gig and don't have a particular goal in mind, or if they do, it's still not clear. It's just they want another gig or they want a better gig, but they don't quite understand what that is, you know, internally. So I think that's probably the most important, because you can't get the other two without that first one, right?
Exactly. And then, you know, the more you clarify things, you know, I knew I wanted to play with Richard Marx. I mean, that was like a goal. It was something that I was really clear on that. And so I literally carved the path where there was a point. First off, I was bold enough to communicate exactly what I wanted. Second off, I was bold enough to suggest how to get there in a different way than was even being offered by Alan Kovac, the manager. Those were two very bold moves. They were all based on the fact that I had crystal clarity that I wanted to do this. And I had done the work, because had I played that gig and my capability wasn't really intact, then I wouldn't have gotten the gig. I wouldn't have gotten the offer to continue, certainly. So you got to back it up with the goods. And that's something, because I've met some people that talk a great game and they don't back it up with the goods.
Yeah.
And that's a very frustrating thing. You have to have the goods. You have to have the capability. And in my case, when I auditioned for Bad English, I mean, the guy that got the gig was Dean Castronovo. and Dean has literally continued working with Neil Sean ever since then. Neil Sean was in Bad English. Yeah. And then I ended up, ironically, doing a tour with Jonathan Cain and Neil Sean, the same guys that I auditioned for, and failed miserably in front of. And when I brought it up to Jonathan Cain, because Jonathan Cain was the one who was the musical director for Bad English, and he was the one that kept on stopping me, telling me I was rushing, and finally whipped out the metronome and talked to me and said, watch the light. I mean, talk about, you know, the most embarrassing, one of the most embarrassing moments of my life. You're auditioning for something world class, and my time was so bad that he's pulling out a metronome and literally like tossing it to me and telling me to watch the light while I play. And then when I brought it up to him, he didn't even remember, of course, but they probably, you know, they auditioned so many guys and, you know, they knew exactly what they wanted as well. And Dean is he's an animal. He's a beast. And he had it back then. He had it before I had it. We get it when we get it. You know, I didn't do my first road gig until I was in my late 20s. So, you know, a lot, you know, by rock and roll standards, that's pretty old.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That's pretty cool, though, that you stuck it out, because a lot of people by that age would say, you know, maybe I should try something else, especially someone that, like you, where you have other talents and other opportunities, and you could probably see other ways to go with your life. So, again, it comes back to the clarity. You had the clarity of where you wanted to go, which otherwise would have taken your life in a different direction.
Absolutely. That's exactly truth.
When does your book come out?
Don't have an exact release date yet. We're working on that.
Oh, okay.
Because we just got the, just literally at the time of this interview, are refining the finished manuscript with the graphics and the formatting and all of that. So I'm still uncertain as to the release date, but I tell people, follow me on Twitter, man. It's at Marky Planet, MarkyPlanet. And that's the best thing, because I will be giving lots of updates, because I want everybody to buy it. It's, and I'm not going to make it too expensive either. I just think it's foundational for anybody who, well, as Shakespeare said, all the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players. Life is a performance. Everything's a performance on and off the stage. So that's why this book is literally has relevance to everybody on the planet, way above and beyond simply musicians and simply drummers. But it's a very, very valuable resource for musicians and drummers that have had any issue. It's more about life lessons than it is even about simple performance. And that's what I like it to be, because to me, I like to be a mentor to people in all ways. Like, I teach people all over the world. I do these private sessions. I don't even call them drum lessons. I call them coaching sessions, because what I do is I take people deeper into not only just technically, because there's a lot of great technical components of drumming one can discuss, but I talk about with people what they want to do, get real clear on your exact vision with your drumming, with your career, with your goals, so then we can carve a specific path of what capability you need to develop. And it's all based on the concepts, and it really works in life. When I do my own life coaching sessions with Dr. Jim, it comes back to clarity, capability, confidence, you know?
Yeah.
And it's funny, because when you have foundational concepts that are really tried and true, they apply to everything, and they can really make a difference. So everything that I talk about, I practice what I preach, and I think that that's critical. And whatever I coach, I get coached on.
Well, that means a lot, definitely. Yeah, you practice what you preach, as you said. I can't wait to read the book, personally, because I've never had stage fright per se. But I'm basically a shy person, and I don't go out of my way to speak to people, and I don't have a problem speaking to big audiences, which I do frequently, but I can't wait to read it, because I'm sure I'm going to learn something. Last question. What's the best piece of business advice that you've received or learned over the course of your career?
I said it earlier, and I think it's really a critical thing to me. I think that your network is your net worth, because how you build your relationships, who you build the relationships with, how you nurture them, how you are of service to people, I think determines your success. And that's something that I really learned. And I learned that when negotiating, or even if I have desires or wants or needs or goals, I always try to give service to others inside of those desires, needs, wants, and goals, because I think that everybody benefits. And I think that good business means that you're clear. It comes down to clarity again.
Yeah.
Very clear about what you want. You're clear about what you can offer. And you're clear about the path. And I think that with good business, everybody wins. And everybody feels a sense of satisfaction and fulfillment from a negotiation. And I think that if you're dealing with any sort of business transaction and any of the parties feel less than satisfied, then it's not a satisfactory business transaction or relationship. I think it can be that way. Even a negotiation. I think that's it.
Well, this is great. Thank you for being with me today, and thank you for your time. I can't wait to read the book, so I'll be following you on Twitter to find out when it's finally going to be published.
Well, Bobby, I'll send your book, brother. Don't worry about it.
Oh, cool, man. Cool.
Just make sure that I have your address. I'll send you a physical book. We're going to have e-books available as well. So I can send you an e-book. I can send you a physical book. I don't know if you're a tablet guy or a physical reader. I happen to be a tablet person more than a physical book reader these days. But
me too.
Whatever the least I can do for you, my brother, allowing me the opportunity to chat with you, and for a guy who's shy, you're very pointed, very informed, and you have very, very concise and intelligent questions.
Well, thank you kindly. Thank you kindly.
I'm grateful to have been a part of this today.
Well, thank you so much, and likewise. If you want to find out more about Mark, go to markschulman.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Schulman, S-C-H-U-L-M-A-N, all one word, markschulman.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyownercircle.com, questions@bobbyownercircle.com. Many, many thanks to Steve Cherubino, who's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. Steve helps put the show together. Thank you kindly, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or you can go to bobbyownercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.